So I wanted to start with you know where it all began for you. You grew up in Collier's Woods. Your dad was Jamaican. Your mum is Afro-Brazilian. So was this a very musical house? I mean, I know your dad played the trumpet, but was there a lot of music going on?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of music going on. My mother, not only my father was playing trumpet, my mother was singing her heart out over the stove, cooking over the stove. My brother was a real driving force behind my musical upbringing. Let's say he is a professional musician. He played with Stevie Wonder, he played with Eddie Grant, he played with Mack and Katy Kassoon, Tina Charles. And he brought me into the four, and he used to take me to a lot of concerts under his coat. At the age of 14, I used to go into places like the Marquee Club. And incidentally, I'm signed to Marquee Records, which is quite ironic. Yeah, and he took me to see bands like Steve Gibbons Band, Jess Roden Band, Snafu. And I was just like, wow, this is unbelievable. And eventually he took me to see Sly and the Family Stone at White City Stadium. And that just blew my mind, you know, seeing Sly and Family Stone there, seeing Edgar Winter's White Trash there, Lindisfarne, you know, all kinds of acts were on at that time. And it was just incredible to witness that.
It's incredible when you look back the 70s through to the 80s. There was an awful lot of different music around. There was reggae was big for a start. The charts had lots of diversity. You know, rock, punk, new wave of British heavy metal and new romantics and whatever. But you were drawn to the sound of Buddy Rich and John Bonham in terms of the drums. They were your drumming inspirations.
Yep. Well, yeah, they were. I mean, Buddy Rich was my first inspiration. When I started at the age of six, obviously I didn't know what was going on. I just took my mother's knitting needles and started to play on the sofa. And that was my introduction into playing drums, as it were. And then she decided to buy me a pair of drumsticks. And then what went on from there was a situation where I was looking at TV. And I saw this incredible drummer in there playing, and I thought, yeah, I want to do that. And that was Buddy Rich. And then I gave it some thought, and I thought, yeah, this could be interesting. And then a couple of days later, I saw John Bonham with Led Zeppelin, and I thought, that's it. I want to play drums. You know, that is my final turning point. And So I took up playing drums. My mother and father bought me my first drum kit at the age of 11. And I actually built a drum kit as well. Built some toms and snare drums to go with the bass drum I had on the kit. And the rest is history. Anyway.
What were your mates like at school? Because, you know, this type of music, I imagine it was more punk, really, wasn't it, around then, or a bit of glam rock? I mean, this is serious.
It was kind of glam rock. It was there's a lot of heavy rock out there as well, still at the time. The punk era didn't really come into the late 70s, really, early 80s. But there was a lot of influence, and there was also a lot of fusion bands as well about at the time, like Mahavishnu Orchestra, Return to Forever, Weather Report, you know, and I went to see those bands as well. My father took me to see those bands.
You had a few talented musicians at your school. What was it, the Rutledge Boys School in Merton?
Rutledge Boys School. We had Mark King there. We had Mike Lindup, Mike Talbot. You know, the list is endless. I used to hang out with these guys. But funny enough, at school, whenever I went to music lessons, my music teacher discouraged me from playing. He said, you'll never make it, Gaynor. You'll never make it up there. So I was kind of relentless to show him that I could. And I used to practice secretly in my garden shed until I come up to a good standard. And, you know, I didn't actually show him at the time, but I believe that he probably watched my growth up, but he didn't really encourage me at the time.
your first pro gig is listed as being when you were 14. So, I mean, that was something, really. Where was it, and what was it, and who was it with?
Do you know what? I can't actually remember. I think the age of 14, I was in a band called American Express with a guy called Chris Lent, who was actually at my concert last Friday. And that was a kind of semi-professional outing, because we used to play a lot of the colleges. But it wasn't a fully-fledged professional outing. That didn't come until later on when I was 16. And the day I left school, I joined this band called The Flirtations, who was a kind of UK version of The Supremes, and we went out on tour.
Was there any doubt that you would not take up a career in music? I mean, was that the only thing on the agenda when you walked out of school at 16? That was it. Music.
Well,
was it.
I mean, my mother and father wanted me to be either an engineer or a chef. They wanted me to get a real job. And I said to them, you know, Mum, Dad, this is what I do. This is what I want to do. You know, and, you know, I proved to them that I could do it. And that, like I said, the day I left school, I went out on tour. And it was quite an intense tour for that age, I guess. I was out for about 3 weeks. And when I came back, you know, I came back with, you know, a good paycheck, as it were. And they said, okay, well, maybe there is a... maybe there's something in this music business. So that proved to them that I could do something.
So those early days, the jazz funk flirtation, if you like. I mean, how did you get into a position after all of that? Because I looked at some of the bands. Lynx was another one you had an involvement with. They were all over the charts.
That's right.
In the late 70s and the early 80s. So it looked as if your career was moving into a, you know, into that type of area, not into rock music.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Lynx area, or the Lynx, or the kind of Brit funk generation at that time, I joined a band called Light of the World as well, which I'm still playing with to this day. And I also toured with Imagination. Again, I'm still playing with to this day. But it was very much a funk movement at that time. So there was a lot of funk acts about, like you said, Lynx, Central Line, Light of the World, Beggar and Company, Imagination, and I was all linked with all of them. So I was cutting my teeth on that sort of stuff before I got into rock.
So what were you doing then, and how did you get the introduction, the offer to join one of the bands who were at the forefront of the new wave of British heavy metal, Samson?
You know what, I can't remember actually how I got the audition for that. I think it was actually being down at a place called Easy Hire, and they were looking for a drummer to replace Thunderstick. Yeah, and I was like, Thunderstick? What kind of name is that for a drummer? Anyway, he used to wear a mask when he played, and I was down at the rehearsal studio, and they said, would you like to just try out some stuff and play with us? Because they were managed by the same manager as Lynx at the time, Terry McClellan. And I thought, yeah, why not? Let's check it out and see what can transpire. So I checked it out, and lo and behold, we got on very well. I loved the music. The music was great. I mean, it was heavy metal or heavy rock, but with great songs. So, yeah, I joined the band, and after that, they said, yeah, we've got this young singer that we want to try out as well, called Bruce Dickinson. I was like, okay, well, Let's do it. So we got to play together, rehearsed, and then we went on to play at the Marquee Club, and from there we went on to play at Reading.
Bruce, as he was known back then. What do you remember what it was like the first time you actually heard the air raid siren of a voice that he's got?
Well, I mean, it was just incredible. I mean, you know, what a powerful, powerful man, powerful voice. And it was just like, Jesus, this guy is, this guy is unbelievable. And lo and behold, you know, a lot of other people thought so as well. And he got carted off to Iron Maiden pretty soon after we played Reading.
It was an amazing story, that, because he always does recount the fact that he was being spoken to by the Iron Maiden boys, who'd come down to Reading to watch that gig and to watch him. And he was actually offered the gig at the time. But the rest, as you said, is history. But it is a bit of a shame. So you leave there in 82, and it's Pete Walsh, isn't it, who recommended you to Simple Minds. Now, what did you know about them, about the band or their style or the direction they were going in?
Well, I didn't know anything about them. I was playing a session with Heatwave at the time, and Heatwave come out with, this album called Current. And, I was playing the tracks on there, and Pete Walsh was engineering on the album. And he said, listen, I'm producing this band called Simple Minds. And I was like, I don't know them. I've never heard of them. Sorry. But he said, well, I'd love you to come down and play some drums. You know, we're down at the townhouse. Come down, see what you think. See if you can come in and play. So I said, sure, why not? You know, just come down and check it out. Came down and recorded most of the album, a good over three quarters of the album. And they asked me to join right on the spot. They said, you know, would you like to come out and tour with us and get together with us? But it wasn't till really Sparkle in the Rain, where I was fully integrated within the band and started to write with the band and arrange with the band. And that was the starting time.
Did you have any idea? I mean, it's a stupid question, actually. I don't know why I'm bothering to ask it, but I will anyway. Did you have any feeling that this was going to be your life for basically 35 years?
No, I mean, I thought it was going to be like a project, you know, that would culminate in probably 2 years at the most, and and then back to playing sessions. But I didn't think it was going to, you know, completely take over my life, and I'd be, you know, a fundamental member of the band.
I'll mention a couple of tracks. I've got to mention a couple of tracks, which for me were the standout. It's funny because none of these appear in a list I saw in an interview you did. Oh, I don't know, it must have been about 7 or 8 years ago, which was the list of the 10 tracks that had the most effect on me. None of these appeared, but Waterfront. I mean, if ever there was a song that was made for a drum sound like yours, it was that. I mean, the beginning of that song, and they used something called a Dynacord amplifier and sampler.
That's right. Waterfront. Yeah, it was a Dynacord bass amp, which Derek Forbes had, and he used to trigger it on the kind of pulse. And it was almost like a status quo kind of pulse. And we turned around and said, yeah, that sounds really good, you know. Can we put something to that? So the keyboard player came up with some parts, and he came up with this kind of bang part. Says, da-da! You know, and I thought, okay, maybe I should put a kind of straight pattern to that. So it was a kind of stomp cut pattern, so gap-da-doom, 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 you know, and everything fell together.
It just produced this incredible, huge sound, and I mean, I've listened to it so many times over the years. I don't know whether many people know, actually, that the song was written about the waterfront in Glasgow.
That's right.
The other track... Because, yeah. I mean, you'd obviously become very big in the UK and around Europe, but the US was still out of reach until, obviously, the moment. Don't you forget about me. Keith Forsey wrote this, or part wrote this. Mm. And originally, I see it was offered to Brian Ferry to sing, but he turned it down. Did you know that?
Yeah, it was Brian Ferry, David Bowie, Psychedelic Furs. Can't remember, there was another artist as well turned it down. So I think four people turned it down before us. So it got to us, and we were like, well, we write our own songs. You know, we don't really record other people's songs, but we give it a try. And we got in, gave it a try, put our magic to it, and, you know, that was the result. Yeah, I mean, it was the first take, you know. We just went in there, mic'd everything up, got a great sound, and we were running through, and I'd done this kind of breakdown in the middle just to kind of lighten the song down a bit, or to have a bit more of a light and shade. Came out, and you know, I came out with this feel to bring everything back in. And
met with John Hughes. This was after the message went back from Jim that, listen, we don't do songs that other people write. But you actually met with John Hughes, and you actually watched the film as well at the time. What was John Hughes like?
He was a very gracious person, a complete gentleman. He's quite flamboyant. But he was a good guy, you know, and the film is great as well. I mean, the film is iconic now, but it was a great situation to be in, and you know, and it proved to be
a Keith Forsey actually flew over to Scotland as well, didn't he, to actually make sure the deal was done, and you did do it. Rest they say is history. I mean, the film was great, and it still is now. Did they actually want to put Alive and Kicking in as well?
I'm not sure about that. I don't think so. I don't think there was any inclusion of other songs. I think it was just that track, which was going to be for the soundtrack, and it
top- the la la la
yeah,
bit,
yeah.
The placeholder, stuck in there because there were no words to cover it. And then when you listen back to it, it's like, well, actually, this sounds pretty good. Let's just keep this in. I mean, these little moments are the moments that create the history.
Absolutely. You know, I think you know, without those moments, I think you know, the song wouldn't have been the same. I think if somebody else covered it, I don't think they would have adjusted the arrangements. I think they would have just played it as is. But being as we're a band, we experimented.
Did you think that it was going to be the hit that it became? I mean, when you listened to it back, you saw the film. Were you surprised at just how huge song was?
I mean, you know, it's a great song anyway. I mean, it is a really iconic song. But I didn't think it was going to be as big as it was. And, you know, to top the charts in America was a real achievement. We did, yes, because we played it wasn't a benefit concert. It was a kind of anniversary concert. And the whole front row was Molly Ringwald, Taylor Swift, Ed Sheeran, J-Lo. And it was in Las Vegas. And I just remember, at the time, it was just like incredible seeing all those people, and they were really fans of "Don't You Forget About Me," fans of the Breakfast Club, and it was great. Yeah, Molly Ringwald's a lovely person.
Lastly, the one final track I'm going to mention, which is I think it's one of the tracks of the decade, actually, by anybody, was "Belfast Child." Obviously, the events around it, the Enniskillen bombing in 1987. But it was just such a haunting song, a haunting melody, a haunting song that, you know, you listen to now and it still makes the hairs on the back of your neck stand up.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great rendition of "She Moved Through the Fair," basically. It's a traditional track, which was kind of altered, let's say. But no, it's a great, great version, a great, great track. You know, it's another track to be proud of.
And so that brings us to the current day. So you have a new album coming out in a couple of weeks' time. Now, everything has now changed, hasn't it? The focus is on you for everything. So you've been in the band framework for obviously many years. You've had obviously the projects that you've done in the past, you know, the jazz fusion stuff, Wrist, the band there, but this is different. So what was the objective when you sat down and thought, and I know you said you've been working on it for 10 years, but when you decided to turn this into a band and a happening thing for this year, what were you thinking of producing as you were putting it together?
Well, I was thinking of, you know, coming out with a solo album, which, you know, a lot of people would like. And, you know, I thought it was just going to be another kind of record where, you know, a singing drummer comes out and sings some good songs. But I didn't reckon on having this impact or this... how can I say this recognition, because it seems that everybody's really gone mad about it, you know, and they're really getting into it, and that really, really pleases me. And it's an honor to have this album out there, because it's touched so many people.
The pressure, did you feel it? I mean, you know, to write, to sing, to drum. And I imagine the key thing here is the middle one of those, being the vocalist. Now, you've talked about the fact that it's taken you a long time to build up the level of confidence to get behind a mic and do it. That's a long time, considering when you listen to it, it sounds like you've been doing it for years.
Well, I mean, it was a process of, like I mentioned before, over the last 10 years, and it took confidence to just come from behind the kit and to sing the songs, you know, and to really hone my craft as a singer, because, you know, I listened to a lot of singers and I was like, yeah, that's a great lick, or that's a great sound, that's a great tone. But, you know, to actually achieve that from the singing point of view, is for me a really fully fledged achievement, because I didn't think I had the capacity to sing, but a lot of people.
It was Robert Palmer, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was Robert Palmer who kind of got me into that, and you know, and encouraged me and nurtured me. But yeah, I mean, it's because of him, you know, I've got to where I am now, and you know, I'm very proud of the product that we've come out with.
Michael Smith, working with him as a producer, has produced a very diverse selection of talent, from up and coming new talent to the likes of Elvis Costello and Spencer Davis. How did the two of you gel together in the studio?
I mean, I've known Michael Smith for some time, and he always used to really be encouraging me about singing and you know, getting ideas together, because I it was down in my head to produce the album at first, and I went to him to remix the album with a fresh pair of ears. So it was down to him to come out with this kind of more modern approach and modern sounding record.
It would be difficult for many people who have been working within the framework of a band as big as the one that you were with for 35 years, to take a break, go back in and start to produce something on your own and make it not sound like it was an album full of songs that could have appeared on a Simple Minds album. But this is such a departure. There isn't anything here that is a Simple Minds track. So obviously it came to you quite easily then to actually put together what is, yeah, from the start, the opening tracks here, Come With Me, Run, up to Keep On Believing, a really powerful rock album.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's an album that culminated in a lot of the songs being cherry-picked for this album. And it's an album which is got something for everybody, you know. You know, it's got ballads on there, it's got rock songs on there, it's got funk songs on there.
The ballad doesn't last long before that guitar solo rips in, though, does it?
Absolutely, yeah. There's a lot of guitar on the album, which is it's a guitar-based album, and it's you know, it sounds fantastic, and James Ford, the guitarist, has done a fantastic job on it. But it's very much an album which is heartfelt in the way that it was written and the way it was put together. And I'm very proud of it.
I've got to mention a couple of tracks which might surprise a couple of people. First of all, for those out there who were aficionados of early 80s melodic rock, there was a band called Grand Prix who produced a song called Keep On Believing, which you've covered. Was a fantastic song that's been sat there. I'm amazed that nobody had ever done it. And when I spoke a while ago, middle of last year, to Robin McCauley about why Grand Prix never made it, it was just like, the Journey comparisons were too big and they were 50 times bigger than us. But that song's a fantastic song. So when did you first hear that?
I first heard that song, back in the early 80s. And I went to, because I knew the drummer. And I used to go down to rehearsals and hear this song and hear this track and hear Robin singing it. And I thought, you know, one day that could work, you know. And this one day is now, you know. And I thought, you know, we have to have this track on the album because it's such a cool track.
And the other one was Addicted to Love, which, again, is another one of those iconic rock pop crossover tracks. Robert Palmer was the guy that actually told you to get hold of a mic and start singing because you've got a voice. Yeah. So good choice as well, because it's a great song.
Robert was a major influence. And when I came out with a rendition on his song, he heard it and he was like, my God, this sounds great, Mel, you know, and it's actually heavier than he said it's heavier than his version. And I was like, nah, it can't be. He said it is. It's really great. It's fun, fantastic. So great that I want to sing in it with you. So he sung the second verse and it was just incredible what he'd done on it.
I suppose the other question is, are you going to do a video with lots of fabulous looking women in it?
Yeah, well, I'd love to. That'd be great. Let's see what transpires, you know. Let's see what the record company come out with and see what they want to do.
So the plans are, in terms of, obviously the album is out in about 4 or 5 weeks. Lots of interest, as you said. So are you going to be getting out? I see you've got a couple of dates penciled in. What are the live plans?
Well, the live plans are to get the album out, and then by the end of June, beginning of July, get out and tour it, UK-wise, and then Europe-wise after that.
Are you going to be able to make that transition, or is it going to be an easy transition to go from massive arenas into more intimate venues, or is that something that you look forward to?
No, it's something we look forward to. I mean, it's kind of like starting again. But it's going to be great to start at the base, build ourselves up, and hopefully build ourselves up to an arena band again, you know. And it'd be great to play for all the fans who have been backing us from time.